We're continuing with our study of Kant, and it occurs to me that, I'm not sure what you're reading, but it occurs to me you may be coming across some strange terms that I probably should have explained earlier. My apologies. But we'll stop now in that, covering his ground floor plan of the mind to straighten out some of the terms. In fact, I started to put one on the board the other day and realized students probably don't know what that means, and I used a different term. So let's go ahead with these and get them out of the way, and then we'll get back to his architecture of the mind, the floor plan he's trying to sell us. The first term I want to explain is transcendental. He uses it all the time. He's offering a transcendental critique. Transcendental means that something applies across the board to everything. That's what he wants. The faculty, the powers of the mind that work in all knowledge. And critique means an analysis and evaluation. So it's not so mysterious after all, but it's a big terms and strange terms to the average person. It's not things we talk about every day. A transcendental critique, that's to be distinguished from transcendent . Now transcendent doesn't mean anything like transcendental. It means across a boundary from. And when we use it of God, we say that God is transcendent, we mean he's across the boundary of all creation. So God created space and time, and his existence is independent of space and time. God created matter. God created all the laws that govern the universe. His own existence is outside that. We use that spatial metaphor, outside. It's not dependent on. Those things are dependent on God. God doesn't need them to exist. And that's what transcendent means. There are other terms. The one I started to write and then backed off of the other day was heuristic. Now, disappointingly, this is just a funny name for of practical value. And disappointingly, this is what Kant says about the idea of God. Kant doesn't say we can know God and we ought to love God and in our own experience honor and worship him. He says this is an idea of the reason, so it can't be proven true or false. And it just gives more order to your life if you live as if God knows what you're doing and cares about you. But in truth, we don't know there is one. We just live as if there were one. I don't know how he thinks he can sell that. I mean, why on earth would people live as though they're accountable to God after getting done reading Why You Can't Know God's Real? I mean, doesn't that put a dent in their fun or something? We're going to see in our last lectures the result of not being able to know that God is real. An atheist, a very famous one, is going to give a clear statement of what life is like on that side of things. But that's what he says about all of the ideas of the reason. They're of practical value. So the totality of reality is an idea, not a concept. We don't include in this idea every single thing that's real. We can't think of a concept that big. But totality refers to, as an idea, everything that's real. And he puts the self there, you remember. And then he's later going to put freedom. We can't prove it or disprove it. But we act as if we are free. And that's what we have to continue to do. There are some other terms also. Phenomena. This is the Greek word for appearances. This is what appears to us. And he's buying the empiricist dogma that what appears, what's just given to our minds, are nothing but, you know the riff by now, right? Colors, tastes, touches, sounds, smells, just the sensory properties. And then he has this theory about all these unconscious activities of the mind and combining that into a thing and then imposing space and time and then the categories of the understanding, imposing logic and math and so on and causality. It's all coming from right inside our mind. But phenomena just means appearances. And that's used as opposed to what he's going to call noumena. And these are both terms derived from Greek. And this means what we know. To the Greek philosophers, Kant uses it in the sense of the thing in themselves. In other words, we speculate that there are things in themselves. He doesn't say why we should do this. If everything we know is inside our own minds, then we don't know that there is anything outside. And he says, well, you know, that's true. But it's an idea of the reason that there are things in themselves. It's one of the ideas that has great practical usefulness. And he tries to sell it that way. So that's another term he uses. He said, what this means is we should live as if we were watched and cared for by God. We should live as if there are things in themselves that, independent of our knowing them. We should live as though we have a self. And he makes a decent argument for that one, and I'm not sure why it should, in his view, only be an idea of the reason. Because Kant argues for it in a way I find convincing. He says that all the intuitions of ourself and our mind and its work and its... We can catch ourselves in the process of theory making or cooking dinner and whatever it is. But he says none of that is the real self, what Scripture calls the heart of a human being. None of that is the deepest identity of the self. Why? Because the self is what's unifying all this stuff. See, the self is what's imposing space and time and the categories and beliefs in the usefulness of the ideas of the reason. So there's a self in back of everything we can see going on. I think that's right, and I find it convincing. Why does he say then that it's something we can't prove? That sounds like a good analysis to me. But he doesn't. He doesn't take that as something we can know. So, one other thing. I did do this before, but he just, the first I know of, to clearly distinguish between a concept and an idea, often called a limiting idea. And I tried to give illustrations of that rather than abstract definitions. But in a concept of something, we pull out a number of its properties, the ones we're mostly interested in, and we think them together in a unity that we regard as a concept of that object, that thing. And I use the example of my luggage coming down the airport conveyor belt, and I'm looking to pull it off. So we abstract some of a thing's properties. If it's a single thing, individuals, we just about never have a complete concept of any individual thing. That would just be umpteen properties to combine and think of. We don't need that in order to use things around us for the purpose that, the, if it's an artifact, the purpose it was made, or it can be a natural thing, and maybe it's a plant we want to put in our garden, and we are mostly interested in the flower it produces and the foliage it produces. And we have a concept of that plant that consists of the major properties that this plant has, major in terms of our own interest. So properties of individuals are very limited, and we all know that. But properties of a class of things, like plants, can be defined. We can name the properties that a thing has to have to be a plant, and then make it complete so that these properties are true of all plants, but only plants. That's what a definition is. So our concept of a class of things can be complete if we can define the class. But we have many ideas that are unable to do that. And I gave as the example the color yellow. If I specify the particular shade of yellow and its intensity and its saturation, then I've got properties that can be distinguished. They can be combined in a concept, and I have a concept of yellow. But I also have an idea that covers all yellows, every shade, every intensity and saturation. And I just use that term. And often we don't have to know the intensity and the exact shade and all that. What color was the traffic light when you went through the intersection? It was yellow, Your Honor. That's an idea rather than a concept. The court doesn't need to know which exact shade of yellow and what intensity and what saturation. An artist would need to know those things to get it right. The court doesn't need to know that. All they need to know is you went through and the light wasn't red. And the court doesn't need to know the exact shade of red, intensity, and saturation in order to make a judgment about whether you went through legally or illegally. Well, I hope that clears this up, some of this terminology. There may be other terms that crop up that aren't everyday English, but I'm sure you can manage them. You can look them up in a dictionary, or even a philosophical dictionary. You can get those things right on your phone and on your computer. So we're going to go ahead now with our evaluation of Kant's floor plan of the mind. Remember that Locke had already used the analogy that the mind is like a box or a chamber that has slits in it, and through that, those slits, sensations come. And there's nothing in the mind. The mind itself is a blank slate, remember? And sensations write on the blank slate. They give us something to think about, something we can know. They come into the otherwise empty room. Kant's hypothesis is, his guess is, the room's not empty. Instead, the room has very specific contributions to make to the bare colors, sounds, touches, smells, and sounds. Now, when Kant thinks about what the mind contributes, and he calls, you know this, you already have it, forms of sensory intuition. That's his fancy word for perceptions. It also has the logical categories of understanding. So for him, merely to perceive something isn't to understand it. You have to understand it in terms of your thinking of the thing in concepts. It can be have mathematics applied to it. It can have logic applied to it. We can come up with a concept that allows us to understand this perception. And those characteristics, he says, are quantity, quality, put onto the vase too, so that the vase, as we consciously experience it, after the mind gets done all these unconscious activities on it, has quantity, quality, relation, modality. Under relation, you remember, was cause and effect. So that we get the idea of laws that govern nature and ourselves. Now, there seems to me to be some significant faults with this, and I started these, but didn't finish them. I think one that I started was to say that this, what comes to the mind, Kant says, must be chaotic. Why? Because it lacks space being ordered by space and time, and it lacks all quantity, quality, relations, and modalities. So if you take all that away, what's left? Well, what's left is chaotic, but he calls it chaotic sensory. And this is a mass or a mess that comes through the slot into the box or house of our mind. And my point was, if it's really chaotic, then you can't even say it's sensory, because sensory properties are known by contrasting them to non-sensory properties. So colors, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells are not physical properties, for example. Physical properties are things such as weight, mass, density, solidity, and so on, and they're related to one another by physical laws. Sensory properties are related to one another by sensory laws. And I gave the example, nothing can be both blue and red all over at the same time as the same person. Occasionally some people have objected to that example and said to me, that's just the law of non-contradiction. That just says nothing can both be and not be at the same sense at the same time. Excuse me, but it's not. Because that would require red and blue to be defined, and colors are notoriously indefinable. So we don't know that by the definition of the terms. So it's not just logical. It's a law that governs our sensory perception, sensory qualities that we experience. We also experience spatial qualities, and temporal, and mathematical, and so on. Great number of, I made a big list not long ago, consulted. You can see what other kinds of properties, at least I think, and the great many thinkers of the past, philosophers and scientists, have distinguished those same kinds of properties and laws and worked with them. And I did not present any argument that that's the exact right list and all the other lists are wrong. It seems to me the criticisms I'm about to make, I'm in the middle of making, apply to Kant and any other thinker, no matter which list they come up with. And I said that before also, in case you missed it. So what we have in this floor plan is the claim that what comes in is chaotic, but it's also sensory. But to be sensory, it would have to have some kind of organization. It would have to be that red and blue can't be perceived as the same object all over at the same time by the same person. That's a kind of order. So it's not chaotic. So either it's chaotic or it's not not sensory, or it's sensory and not chaotic. Now we come over to these. Let's take cause and effect, because that's the main one he thinks he gets out of this. And by this, Kant believes he saves science, he saves physics. He's the champion with the white hat and rides the white horse, and he's going to save Newton's physics from Hume, who has showed us that there are no two things connected causally. There's just regularity we observe. We observe B follow A again and again, and then we have, the next time we see A, we expect B, and the feeling of expectation we call a law. Well, if that's all there were to science, that'd be pretty miserable, right? Science believes in real causes and effects. Kant says, I've saved that. Look at this. Relations are also read in. It's a category of the logical understanding. And we come up with the idea of cause because causality is imposed on this, on all of our sense perceptions. It's one of the ways they're organized. Now, let me interrupt this a minute to say something about this. He's given us an account in which the mind imposes cause, effect, relations on our perceptions. This is his claim. This is all part of his theory, right? He wanted a transcendental critique of all experience. What conditions are required for us to have an experience? And now he offers a theory in answer to that question. Christian philosopher Hermann Doerr criticizes him severely at this point. He gave us a transcendental critique of the conditions required for experience and then blithely offers a theory. Why didn't he ask for the transcendental conditions for making theories? That would be the next step. What do we need to have experience? Space and time, logic, mathematics, sure. We need to distinguish all the kinds of properties and laws and look for the law order among them. That's commendable, but that's not what Kant did. Next thing, he offers a theory, as though there can be no problems about making theories. So that's not true. So Doerr goes ahead to give a transcendental critique of theory making and shows what they can and can't do, and then goes on to construct a Christian ontology. But let's come back to this. Kant's claim is that cause and effect relations are imposed upon our perceptions by our minds. Well, when he explains this, he explains that what is guaranteed by the mind is sequence. That is, we see B follow A. Right? And we see it repeated again and again and again. And we call that causality. And you can call it causality if you want to, but it's not. Let me tell you why. This doesn't save science at all. It saves the appearances in our perceptions. It saves the B follows A stuff. But causality is more than one thing follows another. It's B follows A because A produces B. And he hasn't saved that idea at all. Percepts don't produce anything. What produces the fact that B follows A is the mind. In other words, he's given us an account of causation that's not an account of causation. Think of it this way. In a cartoon, one cartoon character hits the other on the head with a mallet, and a big lump appears on the other cartoon figure's head. Every time you run the cartoon, the mallet's going to hit this guy on the other guy on the head, and a lump's going to come up. Why? Because that's the way the artist drew the cartoon. That mallet that you see isn't producing the lump on the guy's head. The artist did. And that's the kind of causation he's given us. The mind imposes the regularity on things so that we see these sequences, and that's causality. Sorry, Charlie, that's not causality. Because it's not the percept that produces the next percept. There is no causation in that sense, and that's the sense that's used by all the sciences. One kind of thing, under the right circumstances, given these laws, we can predict the next thing because this first one's going to produce the second under these conditions. Not just the second will pop out of nowhere because our minds impose it on what we're perceiving. So I find this an utter and complete failure, this part of his ground plan for the mind. He does not save causality and rescue Newton from Hume. And then when it comes to the ideas of reason, I find his differentiation of a concept from an idea very helpful. I think, for example, we only have a limiting idea of God. God is the self-existent reality that generates everything else. God is unconditionally non-dependent. And everything besides God has been produced, caused, brought into existence by God. And we, of God's being, then, we have only the idea of a self-existent being that produces everything else. We don't have any list of properties we can single out. From that belief alone, we wouldn't even know that God had all power in doing this. Just power enough to produce the universe, whatever that is, need to be infinite. Then we know more about God from Revelation. And God tells us of his goodness, justice, mercy, love, and so all the other properties that God has. And they're properties of his relations to us. This distinction is observed by Calvin, among others. For example, Calvin says that every perfection ascribed to God in Scripture is found in creation, and hence is not God per se, but how God relates to us. So God creates these relations to us that are loving, merciful, just, forgiving, and on, which is why when we summarize them, we come up with things like, he's all good, all just, all powerful, all knowing. Those are summarizing, collecting the ideas that are set forth in Scripture, that are given to us by revelation from God. We wouldn't know any more about the self-existent reality on which all the rest depends without God creating these relations to us. In the Eastern Church tradition, they're called his energies, his works, his efforts toward us and toward our salvation. He wants to rescue the human race from sin and death. Couldn't be better news than that. But all these things are known by us because God created those relations to us. They're really true of him, and he reveals them. So his relations to us aren't anthropomorphizations. It's not us thinking, well, maybe God's like this, and we come up with something that's true of humans. It's God has anthropomorphized himself first and then revealed it all to us. It created us to have a mind and to know and at least occasionally be merciful and good. We share in those properties in a small way, a non-infinite way. Well, I think that's a real contribution, the distinction between an idea and a concept. But for Hume, I'm sorry, for Kant, all the ideas are as if, so far as we can know, there is no unconditionally existing being that has brought everything else into existence. And in Kant's own theory, look at this ground plan when I say it, in Kant's own theory, who is the lawgiver to creation? It's the human mind, it's not God. It's humans that impose space and time. It's humans that impose quantity, quality, relation, modality, that create, that force on the percepts we have, the laws of nature and the laws of mathematics and logic. We ourselves are the sources of creation and lawgivers to creation. And we live with these ideas only as if they were true. That's the recommendation. As if there is a totality of reality, as if there is God and the self is free. We can't prove any of those things because proving is what these boys do. They prove or disprove what's true about the perceptions. And all the mistakes of philosophy, he says, come from trying to apply mathematics or logic to things that are really ideas of the reason, and they're not capable of being conceived of that way. So they're beyond proof or disproof, but live as though they're true. And why should we do that? Because, he says, it has great heuristic value. Heuristic, practical, practical value. It allows us to think about our lives as a coherent whole if we think that God's watching and cares. It allows us to think that we have free will in our choices and our reasoning. You see, there are a great many people in his day, and even more today in philosophy, that are call themselves materialists. And they claim that everything has only physical properties and is determined by physical laws. And that means that freedom is an illusion. The reason we believe what we believe is the way the Big Bang took place and all atoms have bumped into each other ever since to form stars and galaxies and planets and have life arise and evolve up to humans. And so that original Big Bang, 13 billion years ago, determines what your brain believes and doesn't believe. That's their theory. But if it's true, it defeats itself. It can't claim to be the truth, because if it's true of all theories, it's true of the theory that all beliefs are caused by the Big Bang. That, too, is just another theory that the Big Bang makes some people believe. Doesn't matter what you put in the slot. Maybe it's not the Big Bang. Maybe it's the way you were potty trained. People have all different theories about what it is that forces our beliefs on us. But any theory that says that there's something or other that forces all our beliefs has to apply it to that theory. See, what they don't get is that we as Christians believe the self is a unity, that the deepest unity and identity of a human being is in what the scriptures call the human heart. Sometimes they use spirit. And the Bible writers use this term that way amazingly consistently. They weren't philosophers, but it's remarkable how consistent it is. And that means that you can't say that I have free will, or I don't have free will, but I do have freedom of reasoning powers, because they're all rooted in the heart. If the self of a human being, the unity of all that makes up a human, is not free in its choices, it's not free in its reasoning either. It's, what they're assuming is that the will is in the iron grip of physical causality, but somehow their reasoning that led them to that conclusion is free, not forced on them. Sorry, Charles, I won't let you get away with that either. Either the whole human being is determined or the whole human being is free. Now, our bodies are not. They're subject to laws, but what they choose to do is free under those laws. I'm not free to become a triangle by clapping my hands together. Lots of things are impossible for me. But I can choose among all the ones that are possible, and there's a lot of that too. What I'm saying is, don't let anybody get away with saying that we have no freedom of the will, and for these reasons. No, those aren't the reasons. If there is no freedom for human beings, then those reasons aren't the reasons you believe that conclusion. You believe them for whatever reason you think determines the will. It determines the intellect too. There are no separate faculties or powers. They're all stem from the self of a human being. That's our view of a human being, I mean a Christian one. It's hard to deny that the self is a unity. God has to be unity somewhere, because all the experiences that it does all these operations on, if this theory is correct, have to be done by one and the same self. It has to be the same self that has all these experiences. Because each set of experiences is unique to each self, according to Kant. Of course, one of the things he can't know is that there are other selves. I pointed that out too. If we're locked inside our own minds, and all we know is what happens to take place inside them, and if we are actually the contributors of all this stuff that makes the experience possible, if that's all true, then for all we know, we're the only thing in the universe. See, because the self is just an idea of the reason. He tries to claim there's a real self behind all this, but that violates his own principle about what ideas of the reason are. There are ideas the reason can't help but think of that have great practical value in organizing our lives, but which we can't know to be true. As I said in just a little while ago, why can't we know that we have a self? We're intuitively aware of ourself in these operations that are conscious, singling out something to pay attention to, abstracting properties from it, forming concepts, forming ideas. Something's got to do that. Something does it. We're aware that we are the same person that we were when we were 6 or 20. In my case, more than that. We won't go into that. But he says it's only an idea of the reason, and then later treats it as a real thing. So why wouldn't a Christian then be justified in saying, well, God may be an idea of the reason, but we think there's grounds to believe this one, this idea corresponds to the reality too. And Kant has an answer to that. His answer is But all the arguments that try to prove God's existence fail. And he just distinguishes three types of them. First of all, there's the proof, the rationalist proof, that is called in the history of philosophy by a very funny name. It's called the ontological proof of the existence of God. And it was cooked up by Saint Anselm, who was Archbishop of Canterbury in the early 1100s. And his proof goes like this. One, God is by definition the being with all and only perfections. Now, perfection means the highest possible degree of a certain property. So the highest possible goodness is a perfection. The highest possible justice, the highest possible mercy and love, the highest possible power is also a perfection. The highest possible knowledge. So God has all the perfections, whatever they are. It's not all the ones we can think of. We can think of a lot of them, but maybe there's an infinite number. It doesn't matter. God has them all, whatever the list is, and he has only them. Only those things are true of his being. In fact, on Anselm's construal of all this, God doesn't really, strictly speaking, have these perfections. He is them. God's being is the unity of all the perfections. All right, that's what it means to be God. That's how he starts. Then, premise two. If I deny God's existence, I assert something that is self-contradictory. A self-contradictory claim. Why is that? Well, because I'm saying then that the being with all the perfections doesn't have perfect existence. Now, to say that the being with all perfections doesn't have perfect existence is saying the being with all perfections lacks a perfection. I have to contradict myself to deny that God's real. Therefore, God is real. God has perfect existence. And some are trying to show that to deny the existence of God, you have to contradict yourself. If anything is self-contradictory, has to be false. So the denial of God has to be false. So it follows that God exists. What's true is the denial of the denial that God exists. And Kant's reply to that, I think, is quite legitimate. Kant says, there's no contradiction if I deny both God and self-existence, or the, what I'll say, should call that perfect existence. Kant says, I'm not prepared to admit that there is a being with all and only perfections. You haven't given me a reason for that. So it is self-contradictory if I admit to this defined being having all and only perfections and then deny self-existence, which is the perfect existence. But I deny both God and the perfect existence, and then there's no contradiction. See? Take a parallel case. The case of the belief that all crows are black. If I define crows as black and admit that this definition corresponds to something, and then deny black is true of crows, I contradict myself. But if I reject the definition and the blackness, there's no contradiction at all. I deny both. I deny that there's a being with all perfections and that one of them is perfect existence. Then there's no contradiction at all. It also raised, Kant also raised objections in another, put another way. Let's say it that way. He raised the objection that existence is a property of things. And what he means here is that we can describe something by listing properties that it has. Okay? The properties of my briefcase, for example. My briefcase is a certain dimension. It holds so much. It's black. It has brass fittings for locks, stuff like that. But we never say, and it exists. Because existence is just whether there's a briefcase. It's not one property among many. In other words, that thing could continue to be a briefcase if we made it another color and another size. And if we made the fittings out of something else, we could replace all the things that are properties of the briefcase and still have a briefcase. But if we take away its existence, we can't replace it with something else and still have a briefcase. It's just the whole object. So whether it exists isn't one property of a thing alongside the other properties that could or could not be true of it. It's not true of existence that it can or cannot be true and you still have a briefcase. There's another way to put it as well. It's been debated, this point's been debated a lot in philosophy. So one of the ways is to say that a real property has a complement. This means its opposite is also true for any real property. Maybe that's the better way to put this. A real property has its denial is a real property too. Looks weird. Real property is one that has its where its denial is a real property too. So if I say something is red, then it can also be non-red. That things are non-red. There are things that are non-red. If I say it's square, there are things that are not square and have that property. You get the idea? The denial of it is also a real property. That's what we're getting at. Now, if that's true, and that's one of the conditions for a property, that its opposite is also a real property, or could be in the world, then existence isn't a property. Because the denial of this is non-existence or non-being. Doesn't matter which term we use. But nothing can have the property of non-being. If it doesn't exist, there's no thing there. It doesn't have a denial that can, of which there can be real instances in the world. You can't say there exists a thing, X, that has the property of not existing. That's self-contradictory. And it makes it look as though existence is not a property. Now, whether or not you think that argument's the final word on this subject, that's the position I would take about this. I agree with Kant, existence isn't a property. And that means, again, it's not something that you can say as a perfect degree as opposed to non-existence and so on. It's just whether there is such a thing. So trying to prove the existence of God isn't a matter of finding that it has the property of perfect existence. Because that's the whole thing. Not just whether something is an instance of this one property. So Kant dismisses this proof as a failure. He says, no, the ontological proof doesn't work. Well, of course, that's not the only kind of proof that's been tried. There's also a kind that's called the cosmological proof. And the person that's most famous for these is the medieval theologian Thomas Aquinas. And he gave five such proofs. Now, before I give you Kant's criticism and tell you that I agree with it, it's only fair to Thomas to say he didn't give these as proofs to be presented to non-believers that will convince them that God exists. He wrote them for people who already believed in God, to strengthen their faith, not to produce faith in them. And maybe they can do that. I don't find them convincing, but maybe other people will. And all five of these proofs end up claiming that if something, and the different proofs give a different example of a something, if something exists contingently contingently means depends on certain conditions, then something else has to exist necessarily. I exist contingently. Therefore, God, or let's put it something. I'll tell you how he does that. Something exists necessarily, where necessarily means it's required by logic. And then Thomas adds to each of these five proofs, et hoc decimus est Deus. And this we say is God. Now, before we even evaluate this argument, let me point out something that Kant points out, and I agree with. Even if you show that there's something that exists necessarily, which means the laws of logic require it to exist, that doesn't show you any other property true of this supposed amazing thing. It doesn't show you that it's a person or conscious. It doesn't show you that it has love for you. That's the big one, right? If God didn't care about human beings at all, why should we care whether God exists? And Scripture says something like that. We love him because he first loved us. By not loving him and being grateful for all he does, there's something to lose. But Kant points that out. Doesn't mean it has any other property particularly. So it's not God. You can say it's God, but you haven't shown that. You've shown that there's something that exists necessarily, and we say the necessarily existing being is God. But you haven't proven that. But there's something else that troubles me about this, and I've mentioned this before, and I know that most philosophers disagree with it. And that is, along with the Eastern Orthodox, and I put Reformed also, where Reformed means Calvinist, many of them have held that God created the laws of logic and math, the laws of proof, along with everything else. Those are not eternal and uncreated. They're created too. Colossians 1 says God has created everything visible or invisible. That includes the laws of logic and mathematics. Face value, it does. So, in that case, whatever can be proven would thereby not be God. Why do we have laws of logic and mathematics? How does that come to be? It comes to be because God built them into the world, his creation. But God created them. Everything but God depends on God. Now, of course, the people that think that God is to be defined as the unity of all the perfections think that that includes the laws of logic and mathematics. That's at least a weird thing to say. Why are those perfections? I mean, if you're talking about geometry, you could say the perfect triangle and circle and square are part of God's being, but isn't that at least weird? I mean, those don't seem to be the same sorts of things as perfect justice, perfect love, perfect power, perfect knowledge. Oh, and all of logic and mathematics. Whoops. But it's an attempt to save, just to affirm that the law of non-contradiction and the laws of math are validly applied to things that we experience. Consensus, they are. They're applied to things that we experience, but not to God. God's an idea of the reason you can't apply those. I'm saying he's actually right about that, but giving you the wrong reasons. The reasons he's giving are that categories of the understanding don't apply to ideas of the reason. And why not? He just says so. He doesn't give any proof of that. He tries to show that if you do apply them, they don't work. I give him that. He tries to say that if you try to apply them to the forms of sensory intuition, you can construct a proof that space is infinite and it's not. You can construct a proof that time is infinite and that it's not. See, it's not working. You can't apply the proofs. Proving, using the categories of the understanding, either to the forms of sensory intuition or the ideas of the reason. You can't do both. And he tries it on this. And he thinks that by showing that the traditional proofs of the existence of God don't work, that he's shown that too, about God. But I think if the laws of logic and math have to have some account of their origin in a philosophy. And the only alternative is to declare them self-existent too. And that's what these other theologians do. They make that part of the being of God. And therefore it's eternal and uncreated. Because isn't everything true of God have to be uncreated and eternal? It has to be a perfection, doesn't it? And the answer to that is no. No. Not everything true of God is an uncreated perfection. There are things true of God that are not uncreated perfections, such as his relationship to you and me. That's not a perfection, but God tells us that he loves us, each one of us. And he wants to see us rescued from sin and death. That's not a perfection. It's not the highest possible degree of some positive property that makes a thing better to have it than to lack it. God doesn't benefit by being my redeemer. Look, when God created the world, he simultaneously created the relationship being the creator of the world. And he really stood in that relation. That's not a perfection either. It's not true that God has only perfections true of him. If I pray to God, God really has the property of being prayed to by me. And that's not a perfection. So God has billions of properties true of him that are not perfections. And that's where I'm going to end the discussion of this type of proof. It doesn't work either, in my opinion. It may do for some people what Thomas hoped it would do, strengthen their faith, give them some idea of good reasons to go on believing in God. I don't think he's come up with good ones. I don't think that the argument works. And I think that what he should have told people is, this doesn't need to be proven. But he didn't say that. Well, what other kind of proof is there? Well, there has been traditionally another kind. And this other kind of proof is a very old idea. And it was given its best form just a couple of years after Kant died, or before Kant died. It was a couple of years before Kant died. He died in 1804. This proof was published by a man named Paley, who published it in 1802. It's called The Watch and the Watchmaker. So here's what Paley says. If you were walking in a wild wilderness somewhere, maybe you're hiking with a group on safari, and if you had never heard or seen a watch, and you stumbled on one, if you picked it up and examined it, what would you think? that this was one more part of the natural landscape? Would you think that perhaps lightning had come down and struck that rock over there and melted some metal, and the little rivulets of molten metal just happened to congeal into a watch? Is that what the conclusion you'd come to? Or does it look to you as though this thing's been intelligently designed? You open it up and you see how all the parts fit together and so on. Wouldn't that convince you that the watch had an intelligent designer? Then look around the world. It's a lot more complicated than a watch. Look at the stars and the galaxies, how things work. Look at in chemistry, how things go together, how the human body is knit together so that it amazingly does what it does and thinks intelligently. There's a lot more evidence of design in the world than there is in a watch. If you'd make that conclusion about a watch, surely you'd make it about the world. Our time is up, and we have to end there. But in our next session, we'll consider why that argument doesn't work either. And I'll see you then.